When we were just talking just now, Alex mentioned the technique of when you're playing music or something, of trying to not be nervous by gazing kind of at the top of people's heads, and rather than having to make eye contact with everybody, as a way of not being nervous. And interesting, I've always noticed for myself that when I was playing music, that I would never be particularly nervous with large groups of people. I didn't really matter after a while, whether it's one person or 1,000 people or whatever. But what did make me nervous was when there was other good musicians who I respected, who were in the audience, and then I felt that I had to kind of try to impress them, or that I was kind of nervous about what they'd think of me or something like that. And so I still find the same thing is true today, that I don't get particularly nervous speaking, giving Dharma talks, but I do get nervous when my teacher's there. When I had to give it my first talk in front of Ajahn Brahm, I was very nervous. And now the position is multiplied, because I've not just got one of my teachers, I've got four of my old teachers here, all come and they're all listening to my Dharma talk, and I'm sure they're all going to take notes and cross it off the list of all of the you said this, but remember when. And so this is something always to be respectful of in Buddhism, is we always have a great respect and reverence for the Puranacharyas, the teachers of old. And so I'm very lucky to have my four very wonderful old friends here today, who are all my old teachers, and who I've learnt so much from. And sometimes people ask me why I give so much effort and support to trying to help bhikkhuni ordination and so on. And I guess there's probably many reasons, but one of the reasons is because it's always been completely bleeding obvious to me that all the women that I knew were much more spiritually aware and just more spiritually conscious and advanced than the men were. And it was the people, the guests we have here today, all the people who in their own ways kind of introduced me in some way to some aspect of spiritual practice, or challenged my ideas, woke me up, or expanded my thinking in some kind of way. And you know, that tended to be the women who I knew who would do that, rather than the blokes. The blokes are people I'd play guitar with. And so I've always kind of, this has always been something which is very, it's been just obvious to me. And I guess for my first years as a monk and what Manachat and so on, it's kind of something which is in the background. It's not really kind of urgent in its importance. You kind of, there's a few kind of tremors and you know, things, but it's not like part of the culture to worry about or think about or question these things too much. And so it wasn't a big part of my life. But then when I came back to Australia, and then in my time in Malaysia, and then coming back to Australia again, I began to be more and more aware of the great potential of women within the spiritual community, what they had to offer, and what tragic and not merely tragic, but absolutely debilitating loss that this is to the Buddhist spiritual tradition, and certainly the Theravadan spiritual tradition. So So we try to do a little bit what we can to try to bring things back into a sense of a bit more balance and a bit more reasonable and a bit more compassionate. And just now before the talk, we did a little bit of loving kindness meditation, and it's kind of interesting, very interesting practice or meditation for me. And you know, of course, loving kindness being one of the great universal spiritual qualities, and the kind of the great law of loving kindness, you know, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And this is the what they call the golden rule. And of course, the wonderful story when a bunch of pagans came to question Rabbi Hillel, the great Jewish rabbi, lived about 100 years before Jesus either lived or didn't live, depending on which story you like to believe. But he lived about 100 years before then, and some pagans came up to him and said, we'll all become Jews if you can explain to us your scriptures while standing on one leg. So he got immediately hopped up on one leg, and then standing on one leg, he said, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That is the whole of the Torah. Go now and study. And it's a very beautiful, beautiful story. So this is like the law of loving kindness. You just to the giving of kindness and concern for others. It's interesting, I did this multi-faith seminar the other day, and there was a lot of kind of good things, a lot of very practical things, a lot of good sentiments and so on, but I kind of felt there was a kind of a lack of some kind of spiritual depth to it. And actually, I was a bit reluctant to say this, but the most meaningful, I thought, both socially and spiritual statement, the most meaningful statement was a statement of Osama bin Laden, which is quoted. And I was kind of a bit reluctant to say so on the day, but he said, bomb and you shall be bombed. And of course, that's exactly the golden rule, isn't it? Bomb and you shall be bombed. And it's just the flip side of the golden rule. If you want to be bombed, then go and bomb others. If you don't want to be bombed, don't go and bomb others. And in fact, it's actually, spiritually, it's exactly right. It's just morally obscene, that's all. But spiritually, he's got it exactly right. That's just the law of karma. Bomb and you shall be bombed. And so, we want to. You'll be glad to hear I refrained from saying that on the day. I probably should have said something, but what kind of world do we want to live in? You know, like we live as Australians, we live in the age of quote unquote terror. You know, we're wandering around afraid of terrorists. You know, there's all these kind of bearded Arabs sort of muttering in groups everywhere you go. I mean, I'm sure you've seen them, you know, everywhere, kind of muttering and plotting and so on. I think I saw three or four of them out the front of the house just before the talk, you know, kind of strapping on things under their kind of robes and getting ready to. You know, I was all kind of thinking of terrorists, and I did this kind of Dhamma tour last year of Malaysia and Singapore, and I gave talks in, I don't know how many, half a dozen or maybe 10. I don't know, probably 10 or 12 centres in Malaysia and Singapore, and every time I gave a talk, I made the habit of just asking everybody before the talk, did you see any terrorists on the way to the talk? And of course everyone just laughed every time, you know, it shows how ridiculous it is we live our lives as if terrorism is this huge thing. And, you know, of course in America you had the whole terrible 9/11 thing. But even so, even despite 9/11, you still are more likely to die in America by being hit by lightning than by being killed by terrorists. This is the kind of the reality. So we have this kind of this whole beat up of terrorism. And is that the kind of world we want to live in? Is that the kind of world that we want to live in, that we want to create? And so we have that choice, just as the Australian government has the choice to participate or not participate in this kind of world agenda. We also have that choice to participate or not participate in our own personal level. And we can choose anger, we can choose violence, whether on a physical level or a personal level or spiritual level or whatever, or we can choose non-violence. And one of the things I was very pleased at in the multi-faith forum is one of the forums I participated in, we discussed extremism and we had to come up with some recommendations. And one of the recommendations was religion should never support terrorism in any form. And people were not particularly impressed with this. And then somebody came up with a much better one. Religion should not support violence in any form. And when that was suggested, then everyone clapped. And that became the thing that we approved. Because, of course, terrorism is just like a political construct which we build around certain kinds of violence. And the actual reality is violent conduct. So one of the things that Buddhism does, and one of the specialities that we have, is to refer the universal or the social back to the personal. And, and so we say, well, we have to start with ourselves. So there's no good in, you know, as we were talking the other day, going on anti-war marches and trying to stop everyone from killing while being oneself consumed with anger and hatred. There's something very wrong there. There's a disjunction there. There's something which is broken. And they have this idea in philosophy. They have this idea of like the seamless coat of the universe. And that seamless coat is torn. There's this kind of disjunction between our private and our personal lives. And so one of the great strengths of Buddhism has been to bring that reflection back and to make it very personal, make it very immediate. And we're very good at that, and we're very good at teaching the kinds of reflections and meditations which can get us in touch with our own mind, our own heart, our own feelings, our own thoughts. And so this is the reason we teach, like the metta meditation and so on. And of course, you know, meditation is something which is extremely important, but which is only one part of spiritual practice. And I think one of the flaws or one of the problems with some modern forms of Buddhism is that they've taken this very wonderful thing, very beautiful practice, very essential practice, and then they've been so impressed with it that they try to say that it's the only thing, that all you need to do is meditate and then you'll be right. And I don't think that's the case, and I don't think that's what the Buddha was talking about either. And so rather than, you know, then committing the kind of the mistake of sort of operating only on the social level and not looking at our personal attitudes, Buddhism tends to commit the opposite mistake. So we only look at our own personal attitudes and we don't look at the social implications of these things. That's like the opposite kind of mistake. And so the typical criticism of Buddhism, which I think has some truth to it, is that, you know, you'll sit around saying, may I be happy, may you be happy, may everyone be happy, may all sentient beings be happy. But you don't actually kind of do anything about it. And you don't sort of do any constructive work in the world to actually bring this about. And this is, it's not anything wrong with it. There's not anything wrong with that practice, but it's just like a lack of completion and a lack of balance in that practice, which, you know, we should try to rectify. It's not like a huge deal. It's not that big a deal, actually. It's actually, you know, bringing metta, bringing loving kindness into our daily life and their interactions with people and so on, it's not easy. But it's relatively easy compared with doing meditation. And it's relatively easy in the sense that even if there are certain methods and things that you can do to improve things, even if things break down. You can ask for forgiveness, and this is something, of course, that we do very often here in the monastery, because we usually need to. And if you do something wrong and you get annoyed with somebody or whatever and get angry with them or yell at them or say some nasty words, and then you ask for forgiveness. Later on you cool down. And really, it's just a kind of a mood. It's just frustrations and disagreements and all the kind of normal things that people have. And you ask forgiveness, you talk about it, you discuss the problems, and you look for a way out. And, everyone has to listen to each other. Listen to what the other person's saying and try to take that on board and so on, and try to move forward with those things. And these things are all very important and very important part of our spiritual life, and they're all it's not kind of extrinsic to Buddhism. This is not like a kind of a reading of Western psychological concepts into Buddhism. These are things which are found there straight in black and white in the Pali Vinaya. All of these ideas and these practices are all there as tools for us. And so these things are very important. But they're kind of, this is the kind of the ongoing management and growth of our own lives and our own kind of emotional state, which sort of progresses through our spiritual practice. And it is important to notice that this kind of happens at a slightly different level or a slightly different way than the meditation does. And it's something, it's a bit curious that you notice sometimes in Buddhism that you may have some monk or some nun who really likes living by themselves, and they stay by themselves in a cave or a hut and live by themselves and meditate for many years. But then when they come and live in community, it seems like they haven't really advanced very much. They still get annoyed very easily. They still don't know how to communicate. They still harbour kinds of views and ideas and so on, which are not very wholesome or very constructive. And this is something which is quite observable, and it shows us that meditation is not. Meditation by itself is not doing everything, and sometimes it's people who need to look at some of those other aspects of their practice, because they'd rather not look at them, and that's why they go away by themselves to stay in seclusion. That's not the case all the time, but it is the case some of the time. But there is still, having said that, and there are these kind of words of caution and balance about meditation, but we should also bear in mind the thing is very, it has this kind of unique depth to it, which is almost like, becomes very, it's almost like inescapable or kind of overpowering in its immediacy and in its authority. Just that pure act of just looking into one's own mind, looking into one's own consciousness, looking at one's own feelings, looking at one's own thoughts, looking at how you're using the mind, and especially. And most crucially, most critically, looking at consciousness itself, looking at that state of awareness, looking at that shining awareness that is so often obscured, that's so often forgotten, and realizing that actually we carry this unbelievably beautiful and almost like achingly or achingly beautiful sense of consciousness within us, which is, it's something so delicate and so subtle. It's so unbelievably delicate when you start to catch a glimpse of it. You see this thing, and you can't help but talk in terms of paradoxes of something which is so incredibly powerful, and yet so utterly subtle and soft. And even just to catch, as you start, the meditation gets deeper, to even just to start to catch glimpses of it. To start to catch glimpses of what's going on. And, you know, I remember one moment when I first kind of realized this, when I was, I remember a specific moment, walking along a path in Phujongkom. As you walk back from the main sala where we have our dana, we walk back to the huts we were staying. And I remember just turning around the corner there, not far from the main sala, only 5 minutes walk away, and turning around the corner there, and then just having this kind of, I was having quite good meditation at that time, and just having this kind of apprehension or realization of what that is, what that mind is, and feeling just the incredible softness and delicacy of it. And something I hadn't noticed before. And when you kind of become aware of that, you begin to realize how how painful it is when we do things to disturb and distress the mind, and when we do unskillful acts of body or speech to hurt others, and just that the tear and the crushing and the ripping that happens in the mind there, the It's just so dreadful, you know. It's just like this kind of violation of this kind of innocent mind, and you get this kind of realization that if you just kind of leave it alone, just leave the mind alone, that it's okay. Just leaving it alone, and it'll be okay. A kind of sense of trust in the nature of the mind to know itself and to heal itself, and that our job is just to sort of stand back from it and stand away from it a little bit. This is why sometimes when I'm talking about meditation, sometimes I like to say that we do like a meditation object. Meditation object is what you use to distract your mind from the meditation. So your mind becomes peaceful by itself. We don't need anything, and we can't have anything to actually make our minds peaceful. But what we need to do is to give ourselves something to do that's going to actually stop us from getting in the way of the mind, stop us from stepping in there and messing it all up. And so we have this meditation technique. You know, it's like, again, the classic simile of the still forest pool. The Buddha used as one of the great similes for the peaceful mind or the mind of awakening. And, you know, of course, how do you make the water still and clear? You can't make it, but what all you can do is just not jump in it and muddy it up, that's all. So the meditation is about giving us something to do so we don't jump in and muddy up the waters. I mean, I'm saying that half seriously, but it's also something which you kind of experience when you're meditating, that you kind of do the meditation object. You're going to practice a meditation, you kind of do it, meditate, meditate, meditate. And then almost behind your back, the mind becomes peaceful, and you almost kind of turn around and say, "Ooh, the mind's become peaceful. Mind's become bright. It's become clear. You didn't kind of notice it." And this is how it works. And so when you kind of feel that, or when you experience that, then it feels something that's very natural. It's like the natural way of the mind. And one of the most interesting passages or episodes in the Buddha's biography, of course, the Buddha's life story, we don't know very much about actually what he did or what his life was like, but one episode that does record is where he sat down as a young boy under a tree and just sitting down quietly. His father was off working and he sat down under the tree, and under the rose apple tree. And just started watching his breath going in and out, and the mind became very peaceful. He went into a state of like purified consciousness that we, in Buddhism, we call the first jhana. And that was just like this kind of spontaneous experience. And I think it's actually, I think, quite realistic. I think that people do these things, whether children or adults, I think. That they do, you know, we've all been to, in one way or another, where we've been standing under the night sky and we've looked at the stars, and just gazing at the stars and just watching them, or else maybe at the water's edge on the ocean and just looking out over the ocean, or maybe being in the middle of the desert and feeling the immensity of the space in the desert, or and these kinds of experiences where we can get a glimpse of some kind of expanded consciousness. And so this is the kind of thing that we're talking about here with what the experience that the Buddha had, or the Siddhartha, young Siddhartha had. Not necessarily exactly the same thing, but the same general kind of thing. But of course the problem is that those things kind of come and go, and you can't spend your whole life just kind of gazing at a starry sky or standing in the middle of the desert. They're kind of experiences which have a certain, they're very pleasant, very useful, but also quite limited. And so what the Buddha learned, I think, later when he reflected on that, before his enlightenment, he reflected on it and saw just the naturalness of it. And to me, this is the impression that I get from reading that passage, is just the sense of ease and like a kind of natural settling and just a way of being which he kind of recalled and kind of revisited or re-established as the path to awakening. Of course, the state of mind itself is just a state of mind. And we can meditate all we like, realize peaceful states of mind and so on. But that's just what it is, you know, a state of mind is just a state of mind. It doesn't mean anything beyond itself as such. It just is a state of mind which arises for causes and conditions and passes away from causes and conditions. And so if we want our practice to deepen, we need also to understand actually what's going on with our mind. Sometimes that this is presented in Buddhism, and I think it's a bit of a shame, it's sometimes presented as if it's like the job of Buddhism is to like see behind the curtain of kind of reality and then see kind of the ultimate reality, which is what the illusory reality is built up of. And the analogy for that is, you know, you look, you know, it's like physics, you look inside a brick and you see the brick's made up of atoms, which are the kind of the ultimate reality that the brick's made up of. Of course, the problem with that is that it's really derived from very naive 19th century ideas of physics. Actually, brick atoms aren't like, you know, what we saw when we did science at school. An atom's nothing like that. That's just a model which a scientist has invented to make it more easy to understand or easier to explain. And the world just isn't kind of built like that. And I heard the same thing also was said quite often when, I remember when the Matrix movie came out, and, you know, many people were saying, because there obviously were Buddhist themes there, and then of course in the Matrix then, you know, you have the kind of the computer program, and you go beyond and you see the code that the computer program is made up of, and then that's kind of compared with the ultimate reality, the ultimate truth, which you see behind the curtain of truth. But of course the problem with that is that, again, computer code is not an ultimate reality. Computer code is just a set of conventions. So you can see behind the curtain, or like the screen of the computer code, and see the code itself, but that's just seeing another set of conventions. It's not seeing any kind of ultimate reality. And so if you look at actually how the Buddha talked about these things, he never talked about ultimate reality. And he never talked about seeing ultimate reality in that way. The only kind of ultimate truth which the Buddha spoke of was the truth of Nibbana, which is ultimately true because delusion has ended. So this is quite nice. It's not ultimately true because of anything that it is, because of any essence that it has. It's ultimately true because there's no delusion there. Because the seeing is clear. So this is one of the things we have to learn through our meditation, is not so much to sort of look behind the curtain and see the real thing that's lying behind the curtain, but what we need to do is to understand how the curtain is made up. And by the curtain, of course, I mean like the screen on which the movie is projected, the movie of our lives, the movie of our consciousness is all kind of projected on this screen which is apparent to us. We're sitting here inside, as it were, and looking outside, as it were, and on that outside we see our experiences painted. How are we doing that? What's actually going on? How is our mind concocting all these things? How are these things all interrelated? Why do the feelings, you know, make our thoughts arise in a certain way? Why do our thoughts, when they arise, make feelings arise in certain ways? And sort of to unravel these things and look at the complexities, the nuances, and the interdependences of them. And as we do this, we realize how conditioned the whole thing is, and how much it's driven by this desire to make sense and to construct a kind of a meaningful sense of identity out of it. And so this is the Buddha's teaching of not-self. It's just the ability to see that whatever we take to be a self, in that taking there is suffering. In that taking there is suffering. But it's also important to remember that this teaching of not-self is something which is, or should only be developed in its place, and its place is after the development of what we call samadhi. Samadhi meaning like a coalescence or coming together of the mind. So when a mind has come together, then it, as it were, creates a kind of an integrated and whole and healthy self, which of course is what, you know, what like the psychologists mean when they talk about creating a healthy sense of self, is create having this kind of. But whereas in psychology it's more in terms of the kind of the narrative and structures of the mind, in meditation practice it's more in terms of like a direct apprehension of the mind and body in a unity. So you're actually looking at your own mind and body, like looking at, as it were, like an image, like a, you can almost think of it like looking at a glass Buddha image as you're sitting there, a glass Buddha image filled with light. And this is what your mind and your body is like, and you feel that sense of balance and ease evenly through, and this sense of integration, and this it's like a perception, as it were, of yourself. And remembering that the Arahant, the fully enlightened one in Buddhism, is supposed to be somebody who has a bhavidatta, a developed self. So of course this doesn't mean a self in the metaphysical sense of being like a permanent enduring essence, which is like a kind of a soul which kind of takes rebirth and lives in heaven forever or anything like that. But it just means that everything that's here is in balance and in harmony. And so when you can do that, then you can also take that apart. You can also look at how this is conditioned, is compounded, and it comes to an end. But that's not another kind of absolute. You can't reify that either. It's not an absolute. Not self is not like another absolute. And then it becomes a problem. So these things are ways of investigating and ways of seeing. Of course, I'm not trying to imply that there kind of is a self somewhere. I'm not trying to say that at all. But I'm just trying to say that in our meditation, we need to build up this healthy sense of self, and then look at the relativity of it. That look at that not self perspective, and see that this is conditioned. And that whatever we attach to, whatever we take to be the self, this will give rise to suffering. So this is my little talk for you this evening about Dhamma and Metta and the relationship between the personal and the social, and a bit about the progress of Buddhist meditation and the unfolding of consciousness. So I offer this to you for your reflection and amusement. And if anyone has any comments or questions, you're most welcome. Okay, let's finish by paying respect. Sangho, Sangham.